And Patrick Richardson joins me this morning. He's the author of Reports from Beyond, and a huge number of reports in this book and a huge number of destinations visited. Good morning.
Good morning, Darren.
How are you, Patrick?
I'm fine, thank you.
We were having a chat a couple of minutes ago about the last sort of bulk of travelling that you did, which was about 18 months ago, because obviously you've been writing this book back in Edinburgh since. Easter Island and Chile was your last destination.
That was one of the last destinations. And a long-haul destination. Mm. Since then, I've been to the Sudetenland in western Czechoslovakia, which was pretty interesting as well. Old spa towns like Marienbad and Karlovy Vary. But it's really more remote destinations that interest me most of all.
Yes, and that's evident from reading the book. I'm going to start with my own favourite country, to which I've been about 20 times, and the way that you've treated it, it's Iceland.
Iceland.
Which, of course, is in the news for various unpleasant financial reasons at the moment. But nonetheless, you pretty much dismiss all the tourist stuff at the start, like the Blue Lagoon in Reykjavik, and you head to the one place in Iceland where I've not been, which is Ísafjörður, up in the western fjords. Yeah. And it is the definition of off the beaten track. Not even the main road in Iceland, which is Route 1, goes as far as Ísafjörður. So, when you selected places to go, do you deliberately seek places which have perhaps been less well reported or less well covered?
Yes, I do. I'm really interested in very remote traditional communities or societies which are on the edge, or at least on the edge from a European, Eurocentric point of view. I'm very interested in old, decaying, ex-colonial communities slowly slipping off into the past and into time. And the further away, the better. And the more I've travelled, the more I've become drawn to that. In the last few years, my last journeys have been to Western Mongolia, Western Tibet, and to the Pacific, which I completely fell in love with. And I went to places which even I had never heard of before, like the Republic of Kiribati, which is right slap bang.
South Pacific somewhere, is
that's
it?
That's in the South Pacific, yeah. They're the former Gilbert and Ellis Islands, which were under British rule, and when they achieved independence, they became Kiribati in the north and Tuvalu in the south. And that was probably as far away as it's possible to get. I mean, that's even further than Easter Island, and that's really saying something.
Did you find yourself in school looking at globes and maps and looking at these remote places and thinking, I wonder?
Not really, but I do remember at school, I love geography, and I do remember my geography teacher telling me about a place called Chimborazo in Ecuador, and I thought I had something to do with chimpanzees. And I eventually went to Ecuador, and I always remembered my geography teacher, who was a wonderful teacher. But I loved Ecuador. Mm.
The book is called Reports from Beyond. Over what sort of period do these reports extend in terms of time?
Really over about 40 years. I first went abroad when I went to... I sailed from Venice to Israel, where I volunteered to work in a kibbutz 40 years ago, and that was in 1965. And then in 1967, I made an overland expedition, a university expedition by bus to India, and it was really travelling overland to India that woke my travel lust, I think. The sights and the sounds and the smells, but especially the music of Central Asia, I completely fell in love with. And I remember going over the barren deserts of Central Asia towards these seemingly never-ending mountain ranges, which just seemed to recede ever more into the distance. And I remember thinking for the first time, I would really like to see, I'm just very curious to see what's on the other side of those. Mm. And it was then that I realized that that's a trait that's been with me all my life. Wherever I am, I always want to go somewhere else. Mm. I always want to see beyond. And that's why the book's called Reports from Beyond.
Yeah. I mean, what's curious about that part of the world, I guess, is that until about 20 years ago, it was all lumped under the USSR. And now, of course, you have the Stans emerging, you have the former Soviet republics emerging as nations in their own right, some more successfully than others. Is that a transition that you've witnessed? Have you seen both sides of that when these places were formerly part of the Soviet Union and are now emerging nations?
Oh, well, partly yes, because I went on the Trans-Siberian Railway in 1989,
and that's the time to do it, right? Now,
that was a great time to do it. It was just in the just before Glasnost or Perestroika, and I remember being in Moscow where I was about to take the train and seeing the shops, which were just astonishingly empty. There was nothing in the shops except rows and rows, I remember, of bottled beetroot.
Really? You see, that's the cliche that a lot of people have in their heads. That's what they imagine to be the case. But it really was.
It really was, yeah. But curious enough, when I got to, I went to Lake Baikal in Siberia, and then I went south towards Kazakhstan, and I went to Samarkand and places like that. And curious enough, they were actually much more prosperous than Moscow. After that, I didn't really see the. I haven't been to those places since the wall came down and since the Soviet Union collapsed. I haven't been back there. But my trip to Siberia was really something because I then fell through the ice in Lake Baikal, which was quite an achievement.
Because it's about 10 miles thick, isn't it, usually, most of the time?
Well, it's not 10 miles. It's 600 kilometres long.
Yeah,
and it is certainly 1 metre, if not more, 2 or 3 metres thick.
Did you locate the only weak patch of ice on all of Lake Baikal?
I mean, I knew it was very thick, and I sat at the edge of Lake Baikal thinking, I really would like to go out and have a walk in the ice. And I knew it had to be safe because I could actually see little lorries, believe it or not, crossing over like little ants in the middle of the lake. And I remember reading that in 1905, during the Russian-Japanese War, the Russians had actually built a railway across Lake Baikal, believe it or not, to deliver munitions to their troops. So I knew it had to be safe. And so I walked out for about an hour into the middle, not into the middle, but about 2 kilometres out into Lake Baikal. And when I was coming back, I came back a different way and found myself, to my astonishment, confronted by a narrow channel of water about a metre wide. And the only way to get across it was to jump. So I jumped, and I thought I had to be safe. But as I jumped, the whole thing gave way. And the next thing I realized, I was clinging by my fingertips to the edge of ice, and I was being pulled by my heavy winter greatcoat down into the ice.
And you were completely alone at this point?
I was completely alone at this point. And the only thing that could be seen of me was, if people had been on the shore, which they hadn't, which they weren't, if they had been on the shore, they would have had to have binoculars to see my fingertips clinging to the ice. And that was really something. If a cat's had 9 lives, I've gone through 3 of them. One of them was Lake Baikal, that's for sure.
Just with that one experience. Did that cause you to reevaluate anything in your life? I mean, it sounds like as close as anyone would come to a near-death experience, to be honest.
Not really. I mean, I've had lots of dramatic experiences in my travels. And in the book, it seems as if there's just a never-ending catalogue of extraordinary dramatic experiences, and there are a lot. But remember, I've been on the road for 40 years, so that's quite a long time to have it. And the places that I go to, you know, on the whole, the infrastructure is very primitive, and you can expect to have accidents. Like, for example, in the Congo, where I had the train I was on got derailed in the middle of the jungle, and in Vanuatu, I was attacked by a pack of rabid dogs, and so on. So, but I have had a lot of dramatic experiences.
I mean, talking of that instinctive sense that we discussed about you wanting to seek out places off the beaten track, you went to Japan, you went to Tokyo, and hated it immediately.
I did.
And as soon as you discovered, in fact, I think you barely got into Tokyo. It was the journey into Tokyo on the train that was enough to make you think you didn't want to see the place.
That's right.
And you immediately turned around and went to where?
That was the second time in my life that I've done that. The first time was when I arrived in Los Angeles in 1968, and I took one look at Los Angeles and I left on the next bus.
See, I don't think we'd be good travel partners because I love Tokyo and I love Los Angeles.
Yes, I think we've got different tastes. Well, you see, I like very small, very quiet, peaceful places. And I feel really overwhelmed in huge towns. I feel very, very anonymous. And I like small places where you can sit and peacefully watch life drift by on rivers, for example. But to answer your question, where did I go after that? I went up to the middle of the main island there to a wonderful place called Takayama, which was right in the middle of in winter, 2 feet snowdrift, and that was absolutely beautiful because that was what I was looking for. Very traditional Japan with these old thatched houses in the middle of snowdrifts and very small, and people digging their houses out of snowdrifts, and old Buddhist temples with ice melting from their roofs and so on. And that's the kind of place I like.
Some people, of course, say these days that travel can be damaging to the environment. Is that something that you've been conscious of, or are becoming conscious of, or have tried to mitigate the effects of your travel?
Well, I mean, I do have to say I feel horrified when I see the Greek islands, which I love and adore. I mean, my heart in a lot of ways lies in the Greek islands, which I first went to in the 1960s. And when I see what's happening to the Greek islands, you know, beautiful, quiet, peaceful, traditional communities, which are now turned into discos and...
In terms of overdevelopment.
In terms of overdevelopment. Yeah. Yeah. And in terms of what's happened, for example, to the once beautiful Spanish coast, I'm pretty horrified by that. But on the other hand, I mean, tourism does play a pretty large part in the economy of lots of countries, and it's a great thing for people to travel. But I think small scale ecological traveling, I'm fully behind. But the mass marketplaces, I'm afraid, I do tend to take one look at right away.
What would you like a foreign journalist to write about Scotland if someone was in your position from somewhere else in the world and they came to Scotland as you've travelled to their countries? What impression would you like them to have of the country?
Of Scotland?
Of Scotland.
Well, of course, it can't just be of the romantic parts of Scotland, the Highlands and so on. I mean, 3/4 of the population live in the main towns, and certainly they have to go to Edinburgh and Glasgow. I mean, I remember I lived in Holland for a long time, and I had two friends from Amsterdam, and every time they came over to Edinburgh, they immediately bought a ticket and went to Glasgow, which they love and adore, because although it's not beautiful aesthetically, and it's been
ruined, has a rugged charm.
It's been ruined by planners in the 60s. I mean, it's got a ruggedness, and it's got a the cafes in Glasgow are really wonderful, I must say. But for architecture, I mean, I do love Edinburgh. Mm. But to answer your question, a combination of Scotland, the modern Scotland, away from the usual haggis and tatty and neeps and bagpipers and so on.
It's been done, really, hasn't it?
It's been really overdone. But the Western Isles of Scotland are just absolutely fantastic. I mean, I've been around a lot, but there's really nowhere I've ever been like Sutherland. Sutherland and the Outer Hebrides. I remember to inaugurate my new bicycle, I took my bike to Southern Uist, and I didn't know it at the time, but I started cycling from south to north, which was just as well, because I got caught by a gale. And I got blown up the whole of the Outer Hebrides, and they were just absolutely magical. There's just nowhere like Harris, for example, and Shetland. I love
Shetland.
Shetland's
great, isn't it?
Yeah, Shetland's remarkable, part fantastic place.
If we were to open up your passport and look at all the stamps and all the different areas that you've been to, what's missing? Where would you like to go that you haven't yet been?
I haven't been to Benin in West Africa, which has been on my hit list for years and years, but I never made it there yet. And that's probably the next place I'd like to go to. I've wanted to go there for a long time, but especially since I went to Cuba, because in Cuba I became interested in a thing, in a cult called Santeria, which is very similar to voodoo. And voodoo and Santeria came from the Yoruba tribes in Benin or in Nigeria, which are just next door. So I'd like to go to Benin to check that out. I mean, most of the slaves in Cuba and Haiti, for example, were exported from Ouidah in Benin. Mm. And it's a very little known country, but I mean, the Kingdom of Benin in the 16th century was actually a very large kingdom, and it produced an astonishing civilization with wonderful bronze work. So it's got old colonial towns, and it's got an old railway going up into the interior, and it's got beautiful bronze work, most of which is in the British Museum. And I would love to go and see the old decaying ex-colonial French town of Ouidah.
Okay. I think what's clear from the book is, I mean, as hopefully our listeners will have determined from the conversation we've had, is your passion for these places and your passion for travel, and the idea that travel isn't—it's something that can be done for its own sake rather than as a means of getting from one place to another.
Well, when I first travelled, I did travel just for its own sake. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until later that I started writing about it. But after a while, when I did it for its own sake, I'd been to so many unusual places that I thought I really wanted to start sharing this with other people. And for example, I went to South America in 1976, I started going to, I find myself all these unusual places like Bolivia, where Che Guevara had just been shot, for example. And it struck me that, you know, I had been traveling just for its own sake, but it was a shame not to, to share my experiences. So I started sharing my experiences by writing about it in the mid-70s and early 80s. But I do love traveling for its own sake. I mean, there's nothing I like more than just disappearing off, saying I'm away and just you can't see me for a bit of dust. Yes. I do love that.
We're out of time, I'm afraid. I mean, I feel that we could sit here and go around the world for the rest of the day, but sadly we have no time to do that. The book is called Reports from Beyond, and I think we've certainly had a romp through some of the interesting places that Patrick has been to. Patrick Richardson, my guest this morning, the author of that book, Reports from Beyond, A Journey Through Life to Remote Places. Enjoy the rest of your travels. We look forward to hearing from you again.
Thanks, Aaron. That was a pleasure.
It's 9 minutes to 11, 4th to.